Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The internet can be a dangerous place. Users risk harassment, scams, and abuse on everything from social networking sites such as Twitter to commercial websites such as Craigslist and Match.com. Currently, the operators are not liable thanks to a 1996 federal law enacted to shield them from lawsuits and prosecution when users misuse the website, harming others. Victims in several recent court cases have attempted to weaken that shield, saying the law does not protect websites from lawsuits that allege the operator failed to warn users about potential risks. Fusion.com reporter Kristen Brown recently wrote about the struggle to balance safety and freedom of speech. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Kristen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Your article focuses on Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act and how it's designed to protect the internet. Can you give us a brief explanation of this law and how it came to be?
Yeah. So Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act is a very important law. This is a law that the Electronic Frontier Foundation has called the most important law protecting free speech on the internet, and it definitely is. The internet as we know it would not exist today without it, because it would have allowed anybody, you know, in the early days of Facebook or Google when they were small companies to just sue them for, you know, let's say somebody posted a photo of you that they didn't have the rights to. You could sue Facebook. Facebook probably would not exist without that. Mm-hmm. So this is a law that allowed the modern internet and all of these companies that were once, you know, in Silicon Valley garages to become these giant companies that they are today. So it has done a very important job over the past 20 years of allowing the internet to grow. You know, the Congress members who crafted it wanted to allow innovation to run free and to see what the internet could become. And it really has done its job there, I think.
All right. So now we've seen what it can become. We have giants in the industry, Facebook, Twitter, you name it, Craigslist, Match.com. Are websites liable for warning their users about anything?
Right. So under this law, companies will say that they are not liable for anything, right? So all kinds of companies use this law as their main defense. It's the law that Airbnb, for example, uses when cities try and say that it's responsible for making sure that there are illegal listings on the site. It's mm-hmm. a law that Uber sometimes turns to when people try and sue it for its driver's actions. And it is a law that dating companies like Match.com have used when, you know, a bad date turns into a very bad, sometimes violent date. So this case that I recently wrote about is the case of this woman, Mary Kay Beckman, who, you know, signed up for Match.com. She was just looking for love, and she went on a few dates with this guy who she decided was not the guy for her, broke things off, and then he basically stabbed her. He hid in her garage. He stabbed her several times. She ended up in critical condition. She is, you know, 6 years later, she's still receiving treatment for these injuries. She has had several surgeries, and she found out that apparently he had done this to other women he had met through Match.com. So there was a pattern of behavior here. And in her lawsuit, she says that Match.com knew that he was using the website to meet women this way. And so she sued under Nevada's failure to warn law. And failure to warn just says that if you know something terrible, like that there is a creepy, you know, online dater who stabs women in the midst of your network, that you should probably do something about it. So the case that she just recently won, essentially, is that she is now allowed to sue them for failure to warn, because under Section 230, she would not necessarily be allowed to sue them. And what the court did was basically uphold an earlier opinion of theirs in another case that was actually much more clear cut, I think. And that was the Model Mayhem case, and that opinion found that after it was a modeling website, and this woman had used it to get a gig, and she flew to Florida for the gig, and then this pair of people drugged her and raped her, and it turned out that not only did the website know about it, but it was being there was a federal criminal investigation into it, and they did not kick that user off the site. So that was much more clear cut because there was evidence that was very clear that the website Model Mayhem knew that these people were on their site and that there was this pattern of behavior. What this woman, Mary Kay Beckman, will have to prove that she has not proved yet is that Match.com clearly knew that this guy was on there and had used the site to do this to other women. So that's her legal hurdle.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the section of the Communications Decency Act. That's a federal law designed to protect the internet in the early days and now protects websites, any websites, even the big ones, from being liable for who uses their website if it's to harm other people. If you have a question or comment, my guest, Kristen Brown, she's a tech reporter for Fusion.net. She has written about this recently. We'll have a link to her website at WOSU.org/allsides. Questions, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. So this is the woman who was attacked by someone she met on Match.com. The distinction is whether or not Match.com people knew that the attacker had already used the site to lure victims, right? That's what she has to prove. What does she have going for her in that regard? Don't we already know that?
Well, you know, I think that her attorneys must have not realized that that would be the only claim they were allowed to move forward in, because in her original complaint, she actually doesn't really spell out what they know. It just says, this has happened before. This guy had knowledge of this. So we don't actually know at this point how much knowledge Match.com had. And I think that that will be the key thing. She will have to establish that Match.com very clearly knew that this guy had used the site to meet other women and, you know, assault them. And at this point, that's not clear.
Is there any clearinghouse? Do we know to what extent people tend to complain publicly or to the internet companies when things like this happen?
No, I mean, you know, there have been several news stories over time of people getting assaulted.
Sure.
Via Match.com. But the difference here is that this woman is saying there's a pattern of behavior. But I have no idea. Match.com doesn't publicly report anything like that. So they're going to have to subpoena Match and hope that they get what they need from that to prove their case. But the truth is, Section 230 is so strong of a law that even if they are able to prove that, she still may not win on her claim. The Model Mayhem case, which was originally decided in 2014, is still in the process of being appealed, and then another court hears it. So that case has still not even been settled a few years later. And that seems like a very clear case to me of there was a federal investigation. Mm-hmm. They knew that there were these people drugging and raping women via their site. And still that case has not been settled for good because this law is so strong. There's a chance that it could even be appealed again and go to the Supreme Court right now. So if that happened, that would really give us a clear exception to this law. But until the Supreme Court hears it, or if they do, we probably won't really have something that's as clear cut as we might like.
And it's by that, in the meantime, buyer or user beware.
Right. You know, and I think that it's complicated because Section 230, as I mentioned, is a very important law. We don't want, you know, innovation to be stifled. We don't want to create a world where you can sue Facebook just because you don't like a picture somebody else posted of you. But the other fact is that we live in a very different world today and on a very different internet than when this law was passed in 1996. You know, we consider Uber and Airbnb internet companies, but so little of the service they provide actually happens online. So mm-hmm. we have to ask ourselves, is it strange to treat internet companies, you know, scare quotes, internet companies, differently than other companies now in the eyes of the law?
You, some believe that the law crucially protects free speech on the internet. Can the law change without creating a slippery slope? Has that been discussed?
You know, this is something that is very, very hotly discussed. There are many free speech advocates like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, like the ACLU, that really believe that you cannot chip away at this law without beginning to chip away at the very nature of the internet. But mm-hmm. in the Model Mayhem case, the court's opinion was that Section 230 should not be blanket get out of jail free card. And I think that is absolutely the case. You know, the Match lawsuit hinges on a similar theory. The internet companies should let their customers know if they have some knowledge of something actually dangerous. That just seems logical, not to mention moral. So I think what we will see happen is that we will have very, very narrow exceptions to 230 defined by the courts, which we're starting to see now with this failure to warn theory. We've had two of these cases now, but they will have to establish very specific parameters in order for this to be narrow enough to not begin to chip away at the law. You know, how much knowledge does a company need before it does have a duty to warn customers? So I think that that's what we're going to start to see is very, very narrow exceptions for clear-cut things like, for example, the horrible case of you're under a federal criminal investigation because there are people using your site to rape and assault women.
Have there been talk of watchdog groups to do this job?
Of watchdog groups?
Yeah.
I think that there are some groups that have started to do this, but, you know, it's very hard without having knowledge of what kind of information the company receives. Because, again, you know, in order to prove this case, Mary Kay Beckman is going to have to subpoena Match to know how much actual knowledge they had of this. So I think it would be a difficult job to do unless companies wanted to cooperate. And one thing that's interesting is I think that Silicon Valley companies are catching wind that this is the way that it's going to go, that there will be narrow exceptions, that we are about to hold them more responsible, because you have seen companies start to police themselves more, right?
How so?
Twitter is a great example. Hmm. They used to call themselves the free speech wing of the free speech party. They did not want to take any content down. If you'll remember when those horrible ISIS beheadings were posted,
yeah.
Twitter struggled. Should we take down these beheadings of journalists? But so much has changed in the past few years. Twitter now has, you know, a council that looks at this stuff. They now have all these rules about what you can and cannot post. They have banned revenge porn because Twitter has realized that it needs to regulate itself, right? And that is how this law is supposed to work. That is what Section 230's intent was. Section 230 says, you know, we don't know how to best regulate you so that you can innovate, so you guys need to regulate yourselves. And I think what we've seen is that while Section 230 has allowed companies to innovate and grow, they haven't necessarily made good on the self-regulation part, and so companies are just now starting to swing that way. So Twitter is doing that. You have Airbnb has said that it does feel like it needs to regulate itself and has begun working with cities to share some of its data so that they can help crack down illegal listings. So this stuff is just starting to happen, but I think that maybe is the way the wind is tilting. And so maybe we'll have these things dually happening, you know, some very, very narrow exceptions to Section 230, and the companies also doing a better job of policing themselves.
Kristen Brown, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
We will post a link to Kristen's article on these topics. She's a tech reporter for Fusion.net. We'll post a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, more Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Refugees continue to flood into Europe, with nearly all passing through Greece. Displaced Syrians, Iraqis, and Afghanis have often few resources, housing, or food. But many have a smartphone, and the social media access that affords them has become a valuable tool in connecting refugees with each other and in navigating their new reality. CNET News senior reporter Ben Fox Rubin recently wrote about the impact of the smartphone on the underground networks of refugees in Greece. He joins us today by phone. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Thank you very much for having me, Anne.
You reported on the refugee crisis in Greece. Can you give us a brief explanation of what led you to report on technology use among the refugees?
Yeah, the refugee crisis was something that had been covered in many sides over the past year or so. And we at CNET really wanted to take a different perspective, really see how technology may be helping or hurting refugees on the ground and also volunteers, the government, different folks like that, to see if it was actually making a difference in some way, to try to find some way that we might be able to tell the story in a different light through a technology prism.
Yeah, I really finally understood where everybody's going because from reading your story, because you hear about these flood of refugees into Greece, and they say they're overwhelmed by it, but you really never really know, well, where are they and what are they doing? And you talk about illegal sanctuaries for refugees set up in abandoned buildings. They're not government controlled. What are they? They're called squats. Can you tell us what you saw there?
Yeah, when we were in Athens, the city was basically bursting at the seams with refugees and migrants. We didn't see anybody. We had heard afterwards that there were obviously people that were also living on the streets, but there were different areas like the Piraeus port, which is the main port in Athens, that had more than 1,000 people living under an underpass, under an overpass, in an abandoned building, in a handful of different areas that, you know, you might expect tourists to actually hang out in, and they were just kind of stuck there. So, and there were a number of these areas. There was also the Hellenikon Airport, which had closed down, I think, about 10 or 15 years ago, that had turned into just a place for refugees to stay until people could figure out exactly where to put them or what to do with them more permanently or long term. And so there were volunteers and activists in Athens that decided that these housing accommodations were not up to snuff. In many cases, these were fairly squalid conditions for people that had been through horrible things to actually get to Athens or Europe in the first place. And so they decided to step up and create these illegal housing sanctuaries, as you said, called squats. One of the main ones that we went to was called City Plaza. It was an old hotel where about 400 people were living from, I think a lot of them were from Syria. There were folks from Afghanistan, a number of other areas. And this place was in immaculate condition. They had yoga classes there, English classes, Arabic classes, three meals a day. The refugees and the volunteers made the food together, cleaned up together. People had rooms with keys. It was actually pretty remarkable to see, especially considering the fact that none of this was funded by the government. This was all through local donations.
Or NGOs.
There were actually quite a few people that, particularly in City Plaza and some other areas, that were against NGOs. They actually thought that they were part of a broader institutional system that they didn't want to operate with. They had significant preference to operate more independently.
And by the way, you weren't especially welcome there either as a member of the media.
Yeah. So City Plaza was very welcoming to us, and they were very open to the media. They were very savvy in trying to welcome the media in there and show off their accommodations to show that there is a different opportunity. There's a better way than some of those worse housing conditions. However, there's a neighborhood in Athens called Exaria, which is an anarchist neighborhood. It's kind of a no-go zone for the police, and because it's a place where a lot of the city's anarchists are, where they don't believe in borders, they don't believe in governments. This seemed to be a perfect place for a lot of squats, and we actually found a lot of squats there. However, we did end up with a run-in with some folks that didn't like us being there. They didn't like that we were uncovering different squats and essentially made us leave.
Now, the key to all of this and why we're talking about it, of course, is the role that technology plays in the lives of refugees. You mentioned that most of them have phones, or at least someone that they're with has a phone.
Yeah, exactly. And so the refugees would use their smartphones to access the latest information. As you can imagine, things on the ground change very, very rapidly in this type of refugee crisis. And so having access to information, I mean, granted, sometimes it is misinformation, is really, really helpful. They're also able to find these squats, different housing accommodations, food, sometimes work, things like that. For the folks that operated the squats, it was also they would create Twitter pages or Facebook pages. The volunteers would use WhatsApp or Facebook Messenger to be able to communicate amongst each other. And also one of the interesting things was is that refugees would end up connecting with each other as they were traveling. And so you would have these refugee networks that would go across different countries where folks would stay in touch through WhatsApp or Facebook Messenger and be able to relay information to each other that way as well. And so there were these vast networks that operated outside of the NGO establishment, outside of the government establishment, and they were all basically underground and able to communicate very effectively with each other. There was actually this interesting quote that the deputy mayor in Athens told me, where he said that we have a lot of problems here, but one of them is not the dissemination of information, which I thought was really interesting.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and we're talking about how refugees in Greece are using technology to keep things going. My guest is Ben Fox Rubin. He's a staff writer at CNET News, and he recently visited Greece and reported on the use of especially smartphones among refugees and immigrants to Greece. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you could check out Facebook and post your question or your comment there. Now, where do they get the phones from? Are these phones they brought with them? Do they buy them there? Where are they coming from?
So some people did, in fact, buy their phones ahead of time, knowing that they would need them on the ground in Europe.
Okay.
So that was one case. In other cases, people already had their smartphones with them, and they would just take them with them. And in other cases, they would buy them when they were in Greece. And so this was a refugee crisis that had been going on for about a year now. And so a lot of the folks that we ended up talking to were out of money at that point. But as you can imagine, some people were able to travel with thousands of dollars. That's what they would have to pay to get smugglers to get them over the border into Turkey, into Greece, different places like that. And so about a year ago or several months ago, there was a lot more money circulating around. And so people were able to buy smartphones on the ground in Greece when they did need them.
Now,
and that's where they get them.
Well, I have a hard enough time keeping my phone charged. So tell us about the different ways that they're able to charge their phones and get at Wi-Fi access.
Yeah, so charging was an interesting aspect. Basically, every single place that we went to, whether it was an official site or a semi-official site like the Piraeus port or the squats, the charging stations turned into what we described in one of our stories as the new water cooler. You know, so this was a place where people would hang out, they'd smoke a cigarette, they would share information, they would just kind of talk. And you would a charging station was a pretty basic concept of just, you know, just a bunch of outlets connected around each other. Mm-hmm. And then people would congregate and then plug in their phones and just kind of wait for them to charge. But because the phones were so important to these people for such a variety of reasons, they were really critical for them to have for information, for food, for just knowing what was going on. And then I forgot to mention, of course, for connecting with their family members,
right,
which might be in different countries, being able to charge them was obviously critical. And so everywhere we went, there were various places for people to charge them. I mean, they didn't look pretty, but they worked.
You mentioned that how's the Greek government responding to all of this?
The Greek government, in a variety of ways, they were responding. I mean, to me, on the ground, it seemed to me that they were really just trying to keep their heads above water. The Greek government, or the Greek people, have already been through an economic crisis. It was interesting to hear from refugees that have been through war and a number of other things, how they were very appreciative and understanding of the fact that the Greek people had their own problems. And so we're somewhat patient and understanding in some aspects, but it seemed pretty clear to me that the Greek government lacked the resources to really wrap their hands around the refugee crisis. Essentially, what ended up happening was several months beforehand, I think it was especially in March, all the borders closed down. There was an agreement with Turkey, with the EU, to stop the smuggling going into Greece.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially what that ended up doing was that it seized the vast migration that was going on across Europe from mostly from Afghanistan and Syria. And that left about 57, when we were on the ground over the summer, that left about 57,000 people stuck in Greece, essentially trying to find asylum in a country that they had absolutely no intention of staying in. A lot of these folks were trying to get to Northern Europe, either France or the UK or Germany, which they viewed as having a much better situation for them, that they saw a better future for themselves there as opposed to Greece. And so Greece was kind of used as a byway or as a go-between to try to make their way over there. So, as I said, the Greek government was essentially stuck trying to find the solution for 57,000 people that they didn't expect to end up with and that didn't want to be there.
The role of the anarchists is really interesting to me. Is there any way when you're thinking about this that you can describe it in a way that Americans can relate to as far as these neighborhoods that they control?
Yeah, one of the things that really surprised me about going to Greece was how vastly different their politics seemed to be compared to American politics. Maybe it's a little bit different during the political season. There were enormous extremes where there was very far, far, far right and far, far, far left. And the anarchists existed, from my view of it, in the far, far, far left, where they had no interest in authority. I mean, granted, look, a lot of these folks tended to be young, and maybe they lose the anarchist bug as they grow up. Mm-hmm. But Iksaria especially has a long history of being anti-government and being very anarchistic and anti-establishment. So essentially what ends up happening, particularly in that neighborhood, is that if the police do enter, they are usually there can be riots or they can be attacked by the local population, and so it has essentially become a no-go zone for the police. Also, politicians and the media are also warned to stay away for the same reasons as far as being seen as being part of the broader establishment or broader institutions. There are different flavors of anarchists from what I saw, and some of them are more against these groups than others. And some of them were more open to us when we were in City Plaza, which, as I said, were very welcoming to us. Mm-hmm. There were anarchists and leftists that operated there, and we were welcome there. So they don't all fit into one specific bundle.
And they are, as you said, tend to be young and therefore tend to be technologically savvy, ergo their comfort level with the smartphones.
Yeah, and depending on what type of anarchist you are or whether you're a leftist or an anarchist, there were different mediums in which you would use to communicate. And so specifically, particularly with the more hardcore anarchist groups that we ended up identifying, they would use anarchist online bulletins or anarchist-run online bulletins to disseminate information, share information about different police raids, where new squats were, different things like that, whereas more mainstream or leftist squats would disseminate or share information through something that you would expect to be a little bit more mainstream, like Facebook or Twitter. Mm-hmm. Like I said, like a hardcore anarchist probably isn't going to want to find themselves on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I mean, but one of the more hardcore anarchist groups that we did find had an email address, and I believe they had a Twitter hashtag, at least. And it was interesting to see. Also, they would use either their Twitter handles or their Twitter hashtags to request donations. And so there were at least two or three different squats that were utilizing Twitter and Facebook in that way to try to ask for specific things, whether it be food or diapers, different things like that.
You wrote about using Google Translate to interview people. Talk about how that worked for you. And for people who don't know what it is, tell them about it.
Yeah, Google Translate is an app on your smartphone that, you know, you punch in something in English and then it can spit back something in Arabic or French or what have you. So my colleague, Rich Nieva, who I was on the ground with, along with our photographer, James Martin, conducted an entire interview mostly through Google Translate. The gentleman that he was interviewing was better with his English than Rich was with his Arabic, which he didn't know any Arabic. And so that was a way that we were able to connect with somebody that didn't speak any English, that we didn't speak their language. Mm-hmm. I attempted to do a Google Translate interview myself, but I found it quite halting and difficult. Mm-hmm. There's usually a point in the conversation in which you're trying to explain something a little bit more complex than the weather, and it becomes a lot harder to convey your emotions or your feelings. And so it's kind of halting and slow, but when it comes to at least getting some level of expression from somebody as far as what they've been through or how they're feeling, it's at least a starting point, and it's a way to connect with somebody.
You made a really interesting comparison to a talking stick.
Yeah, exactly. And I think because there were so many different languages that were being utilized in Greece, whether it's Greek or Arabic or Farsi, or English, I mean, there were a lot of English speakers among the refugees as well. Using Google Translate in different ways could be really helpful between NGOs, volunteers, refugees, government officials. I don't actually know how much it was utilized, mm-hmm. but it seemed to be a pretty effective way of trying to convey some level of information.
All these refugees in these places, are they living together relatively peacefully?
No. Virtually everywhere we went, we would hear about fights going on. I mean, we didn't see any fights among refugees, but as you can imagine, there are people with limited resources, people living in squalid and difficult conditions, folks living outside in the hot sun, mm-hmm. in tents. They don't want to be there. And on top of that, there are different groups of people from different countries. And so we would hear more than once about how in this particular detention camp or this particular refugee site, the Pakistanis would be fighting with the Afghans, things like that. Again, we didn't see any of it in person, but we heard it enough times to know that just people in very difficult situations, and you can see how emotions can flare up sometimes.
Sure. Sure. Well, Ben Fox Rubin, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. Really interesting article.
Thank you so much for having me.
We'll have a link to the article that Ben Fox Rubin wrote for CNET News, where he is a staff writer, on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Tech Tuesday coming up with Russell Holley on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Apple's iPhone 7 released last week confirmed that the rumors about a new feature, wireless AirPods and lightning cable headphones. The new iteration of the Apple Watch also made some headlines. Joining us to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So the rumors were true. No more headphone jack. What do you think of the wireless replacement for the iPhone 7?
I think I have not heard them yet, so I'm going to withhold most of my judgment. But everyone that I know that has heard them so far has had the same statement in that they sound just like Apple's AirPods that come with the headset. Mm-hmm. And that is not good, because that means that those are $156 headphones that do not sound very good at all.
Now, these are the ones that look like they have little bunny ears sticking off of them, right? But they go down instead of up.
Right. Yeah, these have it basically looks like your AirPods, you know, the headphones that came with your iPhone with the cords cut off when the plastic, you know, turns
right.
rigid.
So what is Apple saying the advantages of spending an extra $159 on these things is?
The real benefit here is, you know, access to Siri, having them be completely wire-free so you can move around. Although I'll also point out that I could never get regular AirPods to stay in my ears. I know that I'm a little different.
I can't either.
So the idea of AirPods being wireless terrifies me because I would lose them immediately. But I definitely see people wearing them all the time. So the idea is that it takes these and it makes them wireless. You can listen to music for up to 5 hours before they need to be charged. And the case that you store them in is actually a battery that also charges them, which is really cool. Apple's not the first company to do this, but it's a really neat design, you know, to be able to charge them while you're not using them. So, you know, when you pull them out, they're fully charged.
It's not new, as you said. Wireless is not new, but it is a big deal with Apple doing it. Why?
Well, the big thing here is that it's removing the headphone jack. You know, Samsung makes these wireless headphones. They're called the Icon X earbuds that work very similarly to these AirPods. But they're, you know, Samsung hasn't removed the headphone jack. So it's not like it doesn't feel mandatory, I guess, if you want to listen to music and charge your phone at the same time. And the iPhone 7 does come with lightning cable headphones, which you can plug in and listen to. They're wired headphones, and they sound just like, you know, regular AirPods. But you can't listen to music through those and charge your phone at the same time, which is almost a step backwards for some people.
Yeah, I think that's weird. Maybe it's a way to discourage people from wanting to use them.
It's certainly possible. You know, they're also, you know, included headphones are usually, you know, people either use them for the entire duration of a phone or they're quickly discarded. So I think it was kind of a decision because something had to go in its place. Mm-hmm. And then they made this kind of upsell option, you know, for people who wanted headphones that were there. And Apple did another really important thing here in that it wasn't just these AirPods that they released for this, you know, because there are people who have more active lifestyles or prefer over the ear headphones. And they actually partnered up with Beats Audio, the company they purchased last year. To make sure that there were multiple versions of these, you know, Apple-friendly Bluetooth headphones. Because that's the other thing about these is that they're limited to Apple products. You know, the AirPods.
They've never done that before.
Right. That when you buy them, they have a very special connection method for iPhones. And they do a really cool thing where once you pair them, it actually uses iCloud to then sync those headphones to your MacBook and an iPad or, you know, whatever else you have connected, which is very cool. It means you only have to connect them once and then they work kind of everywhere as long as you only own Apple products. But it also means that you can't really use them with other stuff. And that's, you know, complicated if you have you know, a tablet that's not made by Apple, or if you, you know, use something else for music, you know, when you're more active, you know, you don't feel like having your iPhone strapped to your arm or something like that.
Yeah. All right. So Apple must know what it's doing, right? They've done this before. It's an Apple. It's always only Apple.
Yeah. I mean, Apple has for a long time now cultivated a very Apple inclusive experience. And the benefit there is that if you own all of Apple's products, it's really cool to have, you know, everything just kind of magically work together. But, you know, there just aren't a whole lot of people out there who own Apple everything. And so the experience becomes a lot more limited in those cases.
What's your feeling about this? Obviously, as we said, it's not the first, but it's the biggest, I guess, or the most splashy reveal of a wireless in this way. Is it ahead of its time? Could this backfire? What do you think?
I think that it's likely for this to backfire. I think that people are more likely to purchase, you know, less expensive, more universal Bluetooth headphones that you know are available pretty much everywhere. Jaybird makes a set that are really nice, and LG, I think, makes a set there that are also very nice that I see pretty frequently traveling just about everywhere. And so, you know, I think that these will be the more frequently purchased and used set of headphones than these AirPods. I also think that, you know, Apple owns a giant headphone company, so they may not care so much.
It's just a frippery. So, all right, there's the new Apple Watch Series 2 and the iPhone 7. They both have water-resistant features. How does the waterproof technology work? Have you looked into that?
Sure. Yeah, so this is you know, kind of an extension of what it is that they did last year where there was kind of a rubber seal on the inside of the casing. So as long as you don't try and open your phone, then, you know, it'll keep water in. But, you know, by applying some waterproofing to the Lightning port, which is now the only hole on the phone, and getting rid of the home button and replacing it with a flat sheet of glass that doesn't actually press in. It removes all of the places where water could normally get in.
Mm-hmm.
And so by doing that, they made it water resistant. But it's important to note that water resistant is not waterproof. And Apple's warranty does not replace if your phone is damaged by water.
Well, how much waterproof is it?
It can go down 1 foot into 1 foot of water for up to 30 minutes.
So you can do the dishes.
You could do the dishes. You could accidentally drop your phone in a toilet. It is it's noticeably less water resistant than Samsung's phones that have been water resistant for over a year now. And it's also noticeably less water resistant than the Apple Watch, which you are supposed to be able to go swimming with.
Hmm. Okay. And as far as the battery life for these things, has it helped to remove that, the earphone connection?
There are plenty of companies who are making waterproof phones without the headphone jack. Samsung, for example, all of their phones have headphone jacks, and they're more waterproof than the iPhone. So it's hard to say that Apple felt this was a requirement. If you look, there's actually a really interesting picture that was shown during the Apple presentation where the inside of the phone, pretty much where the headphone jack goes on your iPhone right now, is replaced by this new vibration engine. It's similar to the vibration engine that exists in MacBooks and the Apple Watch, where, kind of feels like something is tactile, like you're being touched when you try and tap against the screen. That's a big part of what's happening to the new home button. And it really just looks like that took up so much space that they really needed to get rid of the headphone jack in order to not make the phone bigger.
Okay. All right. Anything else? The iPhone is popular, well-established. The Apple Watch is still developing its market. How's that going for them?
So Apple did a really interesting thing with the Apple Watch of this particular generation when they were unveiling this new second version, is that the focus was no longer on it being this kind of premium product that would replace a high-end watch on someone's wrist, and instead was deeply focused on being a fitness accessory, which is what most, smartwatches are aiming at right now anyway. It was really interesting to see Apple move from, the idea of a watch that could, easily compete with Rolex and some of the more popular names of actual watches and drift back down to where the rest of the smartwatch manufacturers are as a fitness accessory.
And does it do well in that regard?
It does amazingly well in that regard. Samsung has been trying to compete with this for a while now, and Motorola has been trying to do the same. Apple's software is very, very simple. It's very intuitive. You just kind of walk around and use it, and it pings you every once in a while when it feels like you've been sitting down for too long or, when it feels like you need to be active. And while that's really annoying when I'm sitting down in a theater, it's super helpful when I'm sitting at my desk and I realize I really have been sitting at my desk for 2 hours and not moving.
Yeah. I was with a friend who has that, and she mentioned that this weekend that she really actually likes it.
Yeah, it's a nice, kind of reminder, and there's a reward-based system. Basically, at the end of the day, you get a series of rings, this graphic that you can look at to see just how active you've been throughout the day, and it's a good way of kind of visually pacing yourself throughout the day to make sure that you're staying active. And for some people who have the, kind of sedentary jobs, it makes a difference.
Now, Apple's collaborating with Nike on the Apple Watch. What do they bring to the table?
So the Nike version of the Apple Watch has a special watch band that is specifically for the Nike phone that you can't buy unless you buy the Nike version of the watch band, and some custom watch faces, and that's it. It's otherwise exactly the same thing.
Speaking of looks, how big of a deal is this matte versus not so matte or shiny black when it comes to the phone?
Oh, it's a huge difference. So it's jet black and just regular black. And the jet black is this really super glossy, just really pretty black that Apple comes right out and says, put in a case as soon as you buy it, otherwise you're going to scratch it to death.
Oh, jeez.
And the matte black is, the same. It's just a darker version of the space gray that we've seen over the last couple of years. So as pretty as the jet black is, I'm not advising people get it because it's supposed to scratch very easily, and you're basically going to need the phone to live in a case.
Right. So moving on. In other news, PlayStation 4 Pro is official after months of rumors. How is it different from the PS4?
The big thing they've done here is added some extra graphics capability. They've adjusted the external design a little bit so it looks more like the the PlayStation Slim that was just recently announced. It's really just a minor upgrade for people who want better graphics on 4K televisions or HDR televisions. If you have a normal high-definition television, you're not going to notice any real difference connecting this to your television. But if you have a 4K television, then this will make a difference in many of the games that you play.
How is virtual reality, part of this new operation?
Samsung is going to be, Sony is going to be releasing a virtual reality headset in October, the PlayStation VR. And PlayStation VR is going to be able to connect to both the PlayStation 4 and the PlayStation 4 Pro. So it'll function just fine. You'll get slightly better graphics on the PlayStation 4 Pro in some of the games, but only games that specifically support PlayStation 4 Pro, which is not all of them right now.
And can we expect any games to be released with this new system?
There will be, a demo disc that will show off, kind of the high resolution functions, but they haven't announced any bundles yet with specific titles.
All right. And what's the price tag?
It's $399, which is $100 more than the current PlayStation 4.
So just in time for Christmas, do you think?
Absolutely. This is a big Christmas play alongside the PlayStation VR. Sony is going to try and get out in front and do the same thing that Xbox is doing, really. The Xbox One S. A little more expensive for people who want those 4K TVs, because this is going to be a big year for people buying 4K TVs, if you believe people who are experts in that field.
What do you tell gamers? How do you recommend they decide between buying the PlayStation 4 Pro or the PlayStation 4 Slim?
It entirely is based on what kind of television you're going to be connecting it to.
Okay.
If you're connecting it to a 4K TV, then the Pro will be, the one that will last you the longest. But if you have a really nice HD TV like I do, a normal 1080p TV that I really like, and I'm not planning to upgrade to 4K anytime soon, the PlayStation 4 is going to be just fine for you.
Okay. All right. And a six-year-old in New York was injured by an exploding Samsung device, not by the same phone that you talked about last week, which was the Galaxy Note 7. It was initially reported that he was injured by one of those, and that's what I heard initially, but it was a different Galaxy phone. What's going on?
This is a Galaxy Core Prime. It was just recently reported was what injured the child. This is a phone that's been out for several years and has a replaceable battery and is in an area that is really commonly stocked with places that sell third-party batteries from cheap manufacturers that are not certified by Samsung. And while they haven't completed the investigation yet, it seems just really likely that a third-party battery was used, and they have a pretty high fault rate, compared to the official batteries. While it's really unfortunate that this kid was injured and nobody wants to ever hear about a phone exploding, period, this was definitely not related to the stuff going on with Samsung's Galaxy Note 7 recall.
Does this replacement battery, if it does come to that, is that illegal to do that?
It's not illegal. There are many companies that make these batteries. They just have, less Q&A, and they sell them for a much cheaper price. You can go on Amazon. You can go into a lot of different stores and find these batteries that are often, half the price of the ones that Samsung is selling as replacements for their batteries for these phones. And it's one of the biggest reasons that there's such high support for phones that just have sealed batteries that can't be replaced because there are so many unsafe alternatives.
And as a reminder, we just have about a minute left, but the people who did get the Samsung Galaxy Note 7 phones, they can get refunds or replacements or what? Just contacting Samsung or going to where they bought it?
Yeah, go to where you bought it. You can, every single store in the U.S. has a way to return the phone immediately or hold on to it until an exchange version shows up, if that's what you prefer. But the biggest thing is to turn it off immediately and wait for a replacement to arrive.
And are lots of people doing that?
A lot of people are doing it, but surprisingly, not everyone. I'm still trying to wrap my head around people who have decided that they're just going to keep this phone that might be a bomb.
All right. Well, we'll try to wrap our heads around it, too, with you. Russell Holly, thanks, as always, for joining us. Always appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's Russell Holly, contributing editor for AndroidCentral.com. Thanks for listening today. It's been Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.